So, film two.
Yeah. The holdovers.
The holdovers. Now, you and I for some reason, I don't know why, I didn't even know what it was about. But I think when I saw it come out, I just dismissed it. I don't know why.
Me too, by the way. I wasn't interested when I saw the trailer.
Yeah.
I thought it kind of looked like it's going to be like The Breakfast Club, which is a good film.
Yeah, I think it's because it was set in a like posh boys boarding school in America. Mm. Like the setting just felt like, oh, I don't know.
Like, where's Jason Statham going to fit into this?
I'm going to take your Ivy League tie. I'm going to shove it down your throat. At the same time, I'm going to take that lacrosse bat. I'm going to shove it up the rectum.
That's what you wanted, isn't it?
Well, it is. But I'm going to start by saying I absolutely 100% loved this film.
Yeah.
Like, more than I've liked a film for a long time, I think. Mm. Maybe the best film I've seen for a year or so. Like, it's definitely my favourite film of this year.
Yeah.
The last 12 months. And I can't remember before that. But it's one of my favourite films I've seen for a long, long time.
Yeah, it's an excellent film. Yeah, I really enjoyed it as well. It's brilliant. Really, really good. It's very classic. It's very old-fashioned. It's so the opposite of The Beekeeper.
Yeah.
The Beekeeper is it's just chucking a load of modern shit at the wall. And whereas this is just a really old-fashioned sort of movie.
Very beautifully written. Everything checks out and works. It all balances off. It all feels very... There's a thing,
isn't there? Structured.
There's a saying, and I can't remember. It was like attributed to someone like Chekhov or whatever.
Which is, if you see a seagull in the first 20 minutes of the film, then make sure you've got Giamatti on board, because he'll sort it out. Just get Giamatti to be in it, isn't it? Is that the saying? Giamatti it.
I was going to say, I think, I can't remember who it is, but it's describing something... When something is perfect or feels perfect, it's got the click of a well-made box.
Ooh.
The idea being like a perfectly made box, when you shut the lid, it just feels...
Yes.
Clink, and it does it perfectly, and it just kind of works. And that's what I got from this film. It just felt like everything moved at the right pace and all went together at the right
clicked,
time.
Clicked, oiled. But that's the balance of a great clockmaker. Isn't that what you're talking about? is a great clockmaker, which ironically, or maybe not ironically, maybe appropriately, would also be a role that Giamatti would absolutely shit on in a good way. Wouldn't it? Clockmaker. Everything
I did think while
place.
I was watching this film, so it stars Paul Giamatti.
Yeah.
And I did think, what have we done to deserve Giamatti?
I know.
We don't deserve it. It's
We don't.
A Giamatti performance, I sound like I'm joking, but I'm not really.
Mm.
It's like getting into a Rolls Royce.
And at the same time, you feel you're in the Rolls Royce and you feel something on your leg. Is it a hand? It's a bit wet, though. You look down and it's the fin of a giant koi carp.
Being played by Paul Giamatti. But being played entirely convincingly by Paul Giamatti.
Being played entirely convincingly by Paul Giamatti. He's playing a giant koi carp wearing a skimpy little LBD, little back dress. And you're putty in his hands because it's Giamatti.
Yeah.
I think his face is like... take like the 10 or like the 20 best-looking hamsters you've ever seen. And then just hammer them together into a kind of mulch. And then crudely
sculpt...
Pour them
into a Giamatti mold.
Put them into a Giamatti mold, then reverse a 4x4 over the Giamatti mold. So crunch the actual mold into the mulch itself.
Yeah.
Crunch it up some more. Then crudely shape it into a human face with your eyes closed.
Yeah.
That's Giamatti. But it's also the most sort of beautiful thing you've ever seen. Like his
and
face
it's
expressive.
It's seeping out hamster blood and viscera, but it's also seeping out empathy. Exactly. And emotion.
It's like a lovely old-fashioned car that's kind of, it clumps, there's steam coming out, there's bits of cables shooting out, there's like conveyor-y bits going around, you're not quite sure how it works, but the whole thing is the most charming and compelling and empathetic. His face is so empathetic. It's like looking into a Japanese carp pond. I don't know. He reminds me of a carp.
That's becoming really clear.
You know, like one of those ornamental carps that have the huge eyes.
Yeah. Or like a big bulbous goldfish. Sort
a big bulbous goldfish eyes.
So let's just explain what the film is. Because I had no idea when I went in. I just went in because you'd been and you said we could talk about it on the podcast. And you said it was really good. So I thought, okay. And the weird thing about it is, what's great about it as well, it's set at Christmas time.
Yes.
So it's like a great Christmas film that came out after Christmas, which is weird.
That is weird. It's very weird. It's a Christmas, it's sort of a Christmas movie. It's a Christmas movie.
But it feels like it should go into the pantheon for me of like good Christmas movies, of which there are about, you know, 20 or something. It goes in for me.
It's funny because it doesn't, it does, it has a tree. I mean, it doesn't hit the Christmas hard, but it is basically a Christmas movie because they're all alone at Christmas, aren't they?
The idea is he's a teacher at a very fusty sort of kind of very Ivy preppy. League style Ivy prep League. School or whatever they call it.
Yeah, like a type.
They're about to go to college.
The ultra, ultra rich.
Yeah.
Pupils, yeah. They're all super black privileged and rich.
And it's going to be Christmas time, and basically all the boys all go off to their various skiing holidays and all their houses in the Hamptons and stuff.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, there are five or so boys who have to stay there because their parents won't or can't have them for the holidays for whatever reason. They've all got different reasons. And Paul Giamatti is tasked with being the man who has to stay behind and look after them. And basically the subtext is he doesn't really have a family or anywhere to go anyway, so what he ought to do it.
Yeah. He's a fusty, grumpy teacher.
Yeah, pipe smoking.
Who just sort of quotes sort of Marcus things in Latin
and
all the time.
Cicero and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so your main characters are him, the kids, and then a chef or like the school cook.
Yeah. Dinner lady type thing.
A dinner lady,
but she's the head dinner lady.
Yeah. Who's played by an amazing actor. I don't know her name, but she's incredible in it.
Yeah.
And her son, so she's not rich and she's not like these other kids. She's black. And not well off, and her son got to go to the school, I assume, because she was working there.
Right, yeah.
And he has recently been killed in Vietnam, and there's this whole thing going through the whole thing, which is he's the only kid that graduated the school that had to go to Vietnam, and the rich kids don't have to go, but he's poor and so had to do that. So that kind of hangs over the whole thing. So the whole thing's incredibly sad.
Yeah,
but then it's funny.
Yeah,
and there was one point, Henry, where I started crying.
Yeah.
But it was at a really odd moment to do that, which wasn't particularly emotional, which was just when the kid said he wanted to go to Boston for Christmas Day, and then Giamatti said, yeah, okay, let's do it.
Yeah.
And just because he was nice to him, and it was that moment of like it's a bit like the midpoint, isn't it? He sort of started being nice to the kid.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think I had a lump in my throat pretty much the whole film.
Yeah.
It's so, like, for some, because it's often, a lot of it's the power of Giamatti and the magnetism of him.
Yeah.
And his character is so sort of tragic and lovable that it's just the whole film was at a point of I'm about to cry, the whole film.
Yeah.
It's just like, it just sort of cranks it up pretty early on and never really lets up.
But also, it does it really kind of quietly. The stakes aren't particularly high, really. Oh, I guess they do get quite high, but it's not. It's not played as if, oh my God, the stakes are so high. It's all like at a sort of very,
restrained.
How do you describe it? Sort of, it's low key, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
But really powerful. It's weird.
Yeah, it's kind of understated.
Yeah.
The only, it's not really a criticism, but I'd say.
Go on, Henry, slam it.
I'd say. It had that thing which is, in theory,
yeah,
the Giamatti character probably should be someone you dislike and then
grow to like, yeah.
But actually, a lot of films I find do this. They don't have the nerve to quite do that. It's clear from the beginning he's an absolute legend. Like from the first second, I love this guy.
Yeah, so really, actually, what you're watching is the other characters realize that he's nice.
Yeah,
but you
yeah.
knew from the beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
But do you think that's what they knew they were doing? Or you think they should have gone for actually?
I think they chickened out.
Right.
Because I think to make a character, because I think to go on a journey of disliking a character properly to liking them or loving them is very powerful.
Right, okay.
If you can do, but you have to have the guts to be dislikable initially.
Can you think of a film where that's happened? I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but I'm trying to think of an example where you
have
do
you seen The Beekeeper? Because I really disliked that woman wearing the purple Mac until she got the Gatling gun out.
And then died 90 seconds later. What a journey.
Yeah. Oh, okay, let's think. Okay, you have put me on the spot, though.
Well, there's lots... I'm thinking of... I mean, this shows how unversed in movies I am, and we are, really.
Yeah.
But the one, the example that's always given all the time about character changes, The Godfather, isn't it? Where, but he starts
the other way
and goes evil.
Exactly, he goes the other way. Well, it's kind of what they do. But this isn't really a good example either. But it's kind. No,
go on. You've got to say it now.
Well, it happens in loads of films. But like Han Solo, in theory, is a bit of a git initially, and then because he signs up to the Rebel Alliance, by the end, he's like a legend. And it's the fact that a nasty guy became... Whereas Luke was always nice. So, like, who gives a shit about him? He's just...
Right.
Like, he was nice all the time.
Yeah.
I need to go to the chassis station to get some power converters. Don't care, mate.
I know what you mean, yeah. But I think what we're talking about really then is, like, is Grumpy Peter Friendly, that being the journey, rather than...
I think Grumpy Peter Friendly is one of the great film journeys, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's what's happening certainly in the holdovers.
Although, you know, in Star Wars, do you remember Star Wars? I mean, it's quite a famous film.
I've heard of it, yeah.
in a strange way, the way... You know the way it ends, the first film?
Is that when they blow up the Death Star?
They blow up the Death Star. And then they're all celebrated in a sort of medal ceremony at the end. It's quite a weird ending to a film. Because, like, normally a film ends, or often a film will end with a happy ending. Whereas it's the most literal happy ending, where literally Luke, Princess Leia, Han Solo and Chewbacca are literally standing on a sort of podium and everyone's cheering and then they get given like medals. So it's like literally we won, literally.
basically, that should be the end of every film. If you stripped away all subtext.
Exactly, yeah. If you get, exactly. That's what we don't need to literally have them on a podium. We can have them sort of like smile at each other and go, well done or something. But they literally, it's like a sort of school prize day. It's really square. They're on the front and it's really square and there's sort of everyone's clapping. It's like they've won Crufts. It's like, yeah, but actually that ending is quite weird in a way because it's almost like he's gone from he's gone from Maverick to total square at the end, Han Solo.
Right, yeah.
Like, you want to keep a little bit of your edge.
Yeah, okay.
But of course, what happens in Star Wars is another great film moment, which really kind of symbolizes the journey from grumpy to friendly, which we've established is at the core of all cinema.
The greatest journey a character can make, yeah.
Yeah. So... Even in a way, that train that comes towards the camera was going from grumpy to friendly because it's coming towards you.
A little bit too friendly.
A bit too friendly, if you ask me.
Back off.
A key sort of structural moment in the journey from grumpy to friendly is the moment where you think grumpy person has buggered off, then they actually know they're back, they're saving the day.
It's the end of Bridget Jones's Diary.
It's the end of Bridget Jones's Diary.
Colin Firth has read her diary and buggered off.
Exactly. But he's actually gone to a stationery shop, which is open at midnight on New Year's Eve. So there's a bit in Star Wars where that happens, where Han Solo comes back. He's like, oh, he's back to save them. We thought he'd been cynical and grumpy and gone off, but he's come back. And I think in this film, in The Holdovers, the journey from grumpy to friendly, he's so friendly already that when he decides to go, he just says to him, should we get a boss? And he goes, yeah. Do you mean he's just being nice?
He doesn't. He actually says no.
Oh, does he say no?
And then the chef woman says,
go on, say yes.
Yeah, it's Christmas Day. Do what the kid wants. Give him Christmas.
Yeah.
And he goes, yeah, go on then.
But I think also he's from the beginning, he's really nice to the lady, to the woman, to isn't he?
Yeah, because the story is that really he hates the kids. That's what changes, right? He's a teacher who has complete disrespect for all of the children because they're privileged. And he's having to give them good grades so they can go to Cornell, even though he thinks they're thick.
And also, he tried to get rid of... He gets in trouble because he wouldn't
give
pass
a
student whose dad had given loads of money to the school. Yeah.
And we learn later on, I won't give anything away, kind of why that has a personal reference to his own life, which is slightly makes sense of why he is so...
So he has principles.
Yeah. And he thinks the kids are just... awful, and then he grows to learn that actually, no, they...
I didn't actually agree with that.
Okay.
Because I think the film gets itself in a little bit of a mess because the film can't say, rich kids are nice. That can't be the message of the film. So they actually, the message of the film is,
this rich one, kid is nice.
That one rich kid, that rich kid was nice. Because, which is fair enough, because, but it's just like, I don't think he...
No, I don't think he's going to...
He doesn't learn that rich kids are nice, or that some... I mean, I...
No, but he gives one of them a chance, doesn't he? And then he realizes that it's more complicated than what he thinks, which is that they're all... You know,
yeah.
He looks into the life of one of them and realizes it's more complicated and there are challenges, and...
Does he realize that, or do we realize that? Because the main thing at the end is he decides to drink drive.
Yes, he does, yes.
Into the sunset, and potentially write a book about Latin.
Well, at the end, he essentially gives up his own job to stop the kid who he's grown to love, essentially, going to Vietnam, essentially, isn't it?
That's true. You know, that is really nice of him.
Yeah. That's really nice of him.
That is really nice. Yeah, he does do that, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Because he's a good kid.
Yeah.
But the other kids aren't good kids.
No. There aren't. No,
we don't meet a lot of other nice kids. And there's quite an... do you remember the kid? There's a kid who's got long hair.
Oh, he's the worst. Oh,
he's
my God.
He's like the jock. He's a jock.
They've cast the ultimate... I mean, that kid.
Yeah.
He comes... He's in his face.
I know. He's just jock through and through.
Deplorable child.
Deplorable, overprivileged jock.
Yeah.
But at the end... Because remember, he's got long hair and his dad refuses to have him back at Christmas unless he cuts his hair.
Yeah, and he goes skiing.
Then the dad comes and picks him up in a helicopter.
Yes.
Takes him off. And at the end, he's got short hair, so he's cut his hair. He's going to conform and become like his dad.
Yeah.
He's going to become a git.
Yeah.
Yeah. But,
Oh, I was thinking of the other guy with longish hair, the really...
Oh.
I know who you mean. But there's another kid with long hair who's like the really...
Oh, well, I know. He's a complete git. Yeah, I mean, yeah. He's an even bigger... But he's two on the nose git.
See, okay, let's come around to the criticism side. I don't think I have any because I was totally taken by it.
No, I think it's a great... It's a brilliant film. I would say the journey from grumpy to friendly is quite heavily friendly. It's seasoned with friendliness. It's less of a journey than you might want. Because he's so nice to start with. I can't think of any film other than Star Wars where it's been pulled off. And Star Wars isn't a great example of it. But I do think there are films, maybe someone can write in.
Yeah, there will be loads of
where you go from really disliking characters to liking them. And also, a character who can go from being morally questionable to morally good, that's the most satisfying journey. Whereas he's always a legend. He's always against the rich kids.
Yeah.
Pro the lady and her son who's died in Nam. Like he is morally in line with the audience from the beginning. So then it comes kind of moral cakewalk for lily-livered liberals like you. Get Statham in there. Let's shoot the shit out of some people. Out of some fucking Gen Z smoothie drinkers. Yeah, I don't know.
We should say it's all set in 1971. That's probably... We should have mentioned that earlier on.
It's all set in 1971. Costume.
Oh my God, right, Henry.
Yeah.
What the world's most iconic duffled coat.
Thank you very much.
I mean, no, I was thinking, it's like your duffel coat. You've got one just like Paul Giamatti.
Well, the duffel coat... I'm just going to Google this to... So does he wear like a sort of a detective style duffel coat?
I wouldn't put a detective in a duffel coat.
Oh, not a duffel. So I'm getting mixed up. I'm thinking, yes, he does. He does have a very good duffel coat.
Which is similar to your duffel coat.
It is a bit similar to my duffel coat. He wears a really good... I forgot what a duffel coat is. Oh, you know, I've got a duffel coat, but I've never thought of it as a duffel coat. I've just thought of it as that coat.
Well, it's a duffel coat.
Actually, it's not a duffel coat, my one. It doesn't have the wooden and the rope. It's very duffel in shape, but it's actually zip. It doesn't have the wooden bits and the string.
Oh, I take it back.
But it is kind of a duffel coat, though, you're right, because I think in every other respect, it's duffel.
I've just put it into Google, and I found a website called jacketmakers.com that sells duffel coats. And this one is selling one called the Holdovers Paul Giamatti Coat.
Wow, nice. Well, I got to say, I thought that...
Clothes.
I really enjoyed the Ivy League clothes.
Yeah.
So
me too.
There was a lot of lovely knitwear. So the hero. Should we look up the name of the actor who played the lead man
Paul Giamatti?
You know, there were other people in the film, Ben.
I was just looking at Paul Giamatti.
You were just looking at a Giamatti haze that spread across the whole...
The young guy, you mean? The
young guy.
Yeah.
So the young student is the kind of... Yeah, one of the other main characters.
And so just to explain, we haven't done a very good job. All the other kids leave for some reason. So basically, you end up with just Paul Giamatti,
a
this three-hander. One kid on his own.
And the dinner lady.
And the dinner
lady. A three-hander. But he... So the leading... Man, boy, should we say? Leading boy?
Yeah. He's 17 or something.
Yeah, he's got a lovely wardrobe, some really nice knitwear.
He does.
Really lovely knitwear. So he's wearing, it's all very preppy. So I don't know if...
Do you know what I liked? I liked Giamatti's brown cords.
Yeah.
And hang on. And then I went out and I bought some...
Ben! Fucking hell, you bought the clothes from the film. You bought the look. You want the look.
I bought some Paul Giamatti brand.
You can get a glass eye.
I've got a glass
all
eye.
All the way.
And we've not mentioned it yet, but I've also got the pervasive medically brought on fish smell that he has all the time.
Oh, that's right. His character smell has a sort of...
It's a medical problem, which means he smells of fish.
That was a kind of weird detail, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Comedy bought those cords.
It wasn't entirely because of the film, but
those cords. But I've got some green cords that I really like.
Yeah,
but they fall into the category of clothes which you've got to be careful how you deploy them because you could end up looking like a fusty old git. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I think there's a thing, isn't there, where like I was talking to my friend Tom Neenan about this because he'll often wear kind of blazers and quite kind of formal wear.
Yeah,
and I was saying that I quite liked what he wears.
Yeah,
and I've always wanted to dress a bit like that, but I don't feel like I can ever pull it off. And he says that he's starting to dress less like that because the older you get, you just start looking like you're dressing age appropriately rather than being like a fun thing.
Yeah. It's tricky that. But I think I think it can be pulled off though.
Yeah.
Because I like the idea of dressing like that as well. So the boys in this school, I noticed that they didn't really have a uniform, strictly speaking, but they were all wearing like tweed jackets.
Yeah.
I don't know if sports coats. I assume this is true, that this happened in these ultra, and maybe still does, in these ultra expensive American private schools.
Yeah.
So they're not wearing, but they're all wearing, I suppose they're all, in a way, they're all dressed like old men, it would look, in
yes.
a way.
Yeah.
So they're wearing like tweed jackets, ties, and like smart trousers and shirts, but they're not a uniform. It's like they've all got their own take on it.
Yeah.
I enjoyed that. And then the main character wears a lot of Oxford button-down shirts under...
V-neck.
Like under, or round necks. Is it crew neck that's called? Crew neck, knitwear, and maybe some V-necks as well, maybe.
Yeah. Brown cords, duffel coat.
Yeah.
I liked
good,
it.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I can't find that word. Someone will know.
I enjoyed the costume element. I've got script.
Okay.
Dialogue.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah.
The only thing I'd say, this is, I'm not being critical as such, I'm just nitpicking, but...
That's okay.
The only bits of slightly eggy dialogue I thought were in the school corridor at the very beginning. There are certain types of dialogue which just cannot be done believably in films, I believe. This is impossible. So like,
it's kind of horseplay between
it's land. Yeah.
Yeah.
Horseplay between land. It's establishing that the corridor in this school of the boys, and it's like, hey, you got my cigarette snake. Get here, your mum sucks my porno dick. And you get like banter, hey, get my porno mag. But I gave you a cigarette. Hey, give me my porno. Hey, your mum sucks. Oh, you whatever. You know, like this. Yeah. It's just, it's impossible, I think. I mean,
I heard you going to the Hamptons for the holidays. Yeah, that's right. I'm taking your mum. Yeah, it's all that kind of stuff.
All that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, prom queen around the laundromat. Cigarettes, all that shit.
Yeah, yeah. And you're right, that did feel a bit eggy.
It's basically, the fact is, film is obviously a complete artifice, right? We're watching an artifice. But because it's filmed, it looks a bit like real life.
Yeah.
Whereas, so if that scene had been played out on stage...
Well, it felt stagey, that first bit where they're all going, I'll take your mum's cigarettes up to...
Yeah, and I'll take it then, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing, though. But on stage, you go, yeah, it's artifice. It's the theatre.
Yeah.
I'm texting someone anyway. I'm not even watching this. Do you know what I mean? It's the theatre. I'm texting.
Oh, Henry.
And I'm marveling.
Thinking about the half, I'm thinking about the interval ice cream.
Think about the interval. And I'm also marveling. I'm again trying to wonder how is it that all of these Maltesers could be next to each other but not melting? It must be something to do with chemicals they put in the Maltesers. Almost certainly kills you, but I'm still going to eat them all. Almost certainly bad for you. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you put any other chocolates next to each other on a hot lap.
No, you're totally right. And they're a bit too shiny, aren't they? They've got like some shiny kind of layer of nanotechnology around them. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
I went to a weird screening.
Yeah.
So it was me, a definitely organized group of about 25 OAPs who were clearly some part of some kind of film club.
Yeah.
Who did the classic OAP thing, which is...
were the rustling.
A bit of that. But this is a big granny move in the cinema. A lot of, when there's moments of sweetness.
Do you
and then
like
a
that?
Lot of saying out loud what's happening on the screen. So there's a bit, for example, where they want to buy the kid a dessert called Cherries Jubilee.
Oh, yeah.
Which is where they've light load of brandy on top of some cherries and ice cream. Yeah. And they won't sell it to them in the restaurant because he's not yet 21.
Hmm.
And so in a little sweet move, they decide to try and do it themselves. So they buy some ice cream and they buy some cherries and they try and light the brandy on the back of his car. And then, but there's too much brandy in the... There's too much fire and they have to put it on the floor and it's a bit of fun. And the woman, one of the women from the group of OAPs went, oh, he's making his own version of it. And just like at every moment, we'd just sort of say what was happening on the screen. Yeah.
Absolute kryptonite to Bonjo, isn't it? To the dark soul of Bonjo.
Well, the real kryptonite then was behind me. So then behind me, there was a group from a college or something. They were like sixth formers who I think had been taken
American
there by
frat
their
boys.
Teacher. Was that?
Yeah, American frat boys.
Well, they were like the Welsh equivalent of American frat boys.
Okay. Yeah.
And they were doing that thing where they were trying to make each other laugh and impress each other by taking the piss out of the film all the way through. And even at moments where it was like really sort of like emotional, or especially those moments, they'd be
awful.
Like, you know, just saying little things and whatever.
Oh, snarking at the film.
Snarking.
I remember. Snarking at the beautiful film. And on the one hand, on the other hand, getting too involved in the film and talking about it. On the other hand, only Bonjo has the mix right.
So I was really annoyed with him. At one point, I felt like turning around and being, please be quiet. Please.
Yeah. Both of you. Both sets of you. That's all. I remember the snark years. I used to do. I used to go to the cinema and felt peer pressured by my friends into snarking at films, which secretly I respected and thought didn't deserve to be snarked at.
It's true. Yeah. I've been there. One thing I thought about the holdovers. This is quite embarrassing. I think there's a moment when I was watching it, where I got a bit emotional, and I think that the part of the emotion was about the fact that the film existed and it wasn't to do with the film.
Yeah.
It was the fact that it had happened and been made.
Yeah.
And like, that films could still be good. Mm. That makes me sound like a snob. But it's so rare to go to the cinema and see a film that isn't Jason Statham like cutting people's hands off.
Yeah.
That when it's this like really well-written drama, I was like, these are quite rare, aren't they now, to watch at the cinema?
Well, that's why I think it feels old-fashioned.
Yeah.
Because it feels like a period piece... Not just because it's set in the 70s, it literally feels like it was made in the 70s.
Yeah.
Feels like an old-fashioned type of film that is quite slow and takes its time. But also, I loved the film. But for
don't
some reason...
Don't pretend you loved the film,
you're
Henry.
Bringing out... No, I'm not pretending. I did. I genuinely loved it. But you're bringing out my naysayer for some reason. I'm not naysaying it exactly, but something that's occurred to me. Think about the cherry dessert thing, yeah?
Yeah, okay, yeah.
That cherry dessert moment... So he slags off the waitress. They then go to a car park and they literally recreate the dessert.
Yeah.
But they bought some cherries and some brandy, which they pour on top of it and they light it on a car bonnet or whatever. And it just explodes. But it's such a kind of... That moment, right? It feels vintage. It feels like an old-fashioned film kind of moment.
Yeah.
Where... But also it feels... To me, like, I can slightly see the cogs going. It's a manipulative moment. The film is, but that's not necessarily a bad thing, but the film is ultra manipulative.
Right.
Because I feel like it has this feeling to it, that it comes from like a sort of tradition of American filmmaking where they've broken down how to control the audience emotionally, how to get Bonjo Partridge,
famously one of the most cynical, heartless, cold people
in Wales.
Yeah.
Blubbering.
Yeah.
Blubbering and, you know, moved to tears by the very existence of the film.
Mm.
And what's happening there is gears, systems, archetypes, plot structures that are designed with a kind of like industrial precision to emotionally have an effect on the viewer.
But aren't you now like basically pulling apart the idea of drama and like...
Welcome to Film Corner, motherfucker. If you can handle it, then stay in the corner. If you can't...
Go in the other corner.
Go in the other corner.
That's right, Snacks Corner.
And just go to Snacks Corner. Let's cool down for a bit. We've got a variety of cheesy biscuits.
And then you can come back to Film Corner if you want.
You can come back to Film Corner if you want, but you'll be on the other side, then you'll have cornered us. So it's like, whose corner is whose?
Yeah. Anyway, so you were saying about that moment then you think is uniquely or more manipulative than other things?
Yeah, it feels like that will have a... I've never been asked to read any of these books, but in Robert McKee's story...
Killing the Cat, whatever it's called.
Or whatever. Yeah, there's all these famous like tomes of these American film structure books.
Yeah.
There were that moment, and that is not a coincidence. But also, you know, also what happens is when you see enough films, you start to slightly recognise, and that moment is, that'll be, that's like... Chapter 7, Part 9, The Cherry Cake. The Cherry Cake Reversal. That'll be a moment where the character...
By lighting the cherry cake, he's burning his old self.
He's burning his old self and turning into his new self. Exactly. You have to destroy the past. They often talk about the moment in... have you seen Romancing the Stone with Kathleen Turner and Michael Douglas?
I've not.
Okay. There's a moment where they go into the jungle and she kicks off her high heels sort of break.
Right.
And that's her destroying her previous...
I see, yeah. She's breaking free from the high heels.
Yeah. Yeah. But the cherry cake moment is like he intercepts on behalf of the boy, together they rebel together against society or something. Like he makes a stand and there's an action attributed to it, which is the cherry cake is then... They then create the new world together or something. Oh, fuck no. You know what I mean?
But
it's so... But you don't accidentally end up with a film like that. Like that guy, the writer.
But the fact that it was written with intention isn't a problem, is it?
No. It's tricky. It's almost like...
You want to disguise it somehow.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying I was aware of being in the hands of... imagine being seduced by an expert but older lover.
But this is what I responded to. Because I think I was responding to like, oh, this is so well made. And I could feel it being well made in front of me.
Yeah.
And when everything happened, it was like, this is well made. And that's what I liked about it. And I think because you and me, in our own ways, have struggled with scripts and tried to make them make sense and put them in the right order and get the pace right. And when you watch one where you're just like, oh, you're really nailing it all the time from all angles, it just felt very like...
Oh, it was like, as you say, it was like being nailed from all angles by a sophisticated older lover.
Played by Paul Giamatti.
Yeah.
So, I know exactly what you're saying, but for me, that's kind of what I enjoyed about it. Right, what's the next format point?
Plementential.
No, there's others before then.
So we've done script, we've done costume.
Yeah, we've done costume.
Music, can't remember.
Really good.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, it was like sort of, I don't know what it was, but it sounded like kind of a bit like... If I remember correctly, a bit like Nick Drake or something.
Oh.
You know, there's a shot at the beginning when they're walking around
Very good.
The campus and it's snowing and then...
It was like a singer-songwriter from the era, it sounded like.
It sounded like it was from the era. Yeah.
And it came back, that song, didn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was great. But I don't know...
Yes, it was very... Yes. It was just like stick a nice moving song on the beginning to just get people blubbing from the outset.
But why not, you know?
Yeah. Get some preppy boys walking through snowy landscape.
Exactly.
An irascible teacher.
Okay, so music, what's next? Is it plementability?
So plementential.
Plementential. Well, in this film, I wouldn't want to replace Paul Giamatti with Plemons.
But the boy, maybe?
Well...
It is referred to that he's gone back a year, so maybe he's gone
he's
back
a bit older
like
than he's meant to
20
be,
years.
Yeah. I don't think it could be Plemons.
Yeah, you're right.
I similarly don't I think Plemons could play the black woman who's mourning her son. I don't think that's going to work.
I think he wants to have a think about about getting a new agent, if that even crosses his desk.
If that comes across his email account, yeah.
If that comes across his email, he needs to have the agent chat.
Yeah. So I wonder whether this might be a film where there actually isn't room for Jesse Plemons.
Okay, first of all, fuck you.
Is it too early to be subverting the format?
I think it might be too early. No, I mean, could Plemons... could Plemons have played the young Korean boy?
No.
No, he couldn't.
No.
I just don't think
there just isn't a role for him.
I think there's no Plemons potential. It's fine.
And then it's yay say or nay say, is it, to finish off?
Well, I don't think it's any surprise that it's a strong yay from me.
It's a honking yay from me.
It's a massive yay from you.
Yeah.
It's a really good film. It's like getting in, as you say, it's like sort of getting into a nice old-fashioned cable car in a Swiss resort.
Yes.
And you're like, bloody hell, this is enjoyable. This is classic.
Yeah.
Every detail on this has been thought through. The wooden finish on the door handles.
The burnished brass.
The burnished brass fittings. And if there's someone in the corner saying, God, I mean, it's a bit manipulative the way they've got, you know, little leather bonkets on each side in case you get tired, then that person should probably get shoved out the window.
So, big yay say for Holdovers.
Yeah.
It's nommed for Best Picture.
It's made the noms.
At the Oscars. And it feels like it probably wouldn't win because it doesn't feel like an Oscar film, does it? But, and Oppenheimer's a big, big honking...
I think it's too... You know what it is? It's a film that is... It's, in a way... Well, you might not like this, but I think it's almost so conventional that it's unconventional. It's like, you know what?
Yes.
Well, it's actually radical that this is a decent bicycle with a strong hard leather seat and a good big bell that makes a big clanking bell noise on the front.
And it's got one of those things where it powers the light when you cycle it. What's that called?
Yeah, it's got a good dynamo light system, hefty dynamo on the back.
Yeah.
And actually, this is the new punk. This is radical because it's so classic.
Yes. Yes.
That's what it is.
But it's not trendy, no.
But it's not trendy.
So there we are. I mean, I really think that potentially was... I mean, it's very long.
Are we going to stick that out as one thing?
I think we'll put it out, but I think some people will be actively annoyed by it.
Because I think we could put it out as two.
Yeah, but there were references in it to the Beefeater.
I know, but once you've seen... If you listen to the first and the second.
But then you may as well put it out as one.
Or you could put them out as two at the same time. I just wonder if it's like something psychologically about literally looking at your phone, there's 2.5 hours of this shit.
I think you're right.
Break it up. Do you know what I mean? Break it up, mate.
Lovely. Well, thanks for listening. Yeah, if you've got this far, do go and see The Holdovers, I would say.
Yeah.
Or The Beekeeper.
Take part in the conversation. Get involved.